How are your charitable donations tracking right now? Yeah, it might not surprise you to hear there's been a decline in gifts in wills over the past two rather challenging years. That's according to the Fundraising Institute of Australia. Well, today we're hearing from two people who are bucking that trend, and we'll find out why and how they're doing that. Dorothy Hoddinott and David Waterhouse, thanks for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thank you.
Now, David, you've made a bequest to the World Wildlife Fund and some other animal conservation charities as well. Tell us a bit about where your love of animals began.
Well, I was probably almost born with it, I think. My parents told me that I always seemed to be interested from a very young age, and I was fascinated by anything to do with wild mammals first, and then later, about 12 years old, I got interested in birds, and then gradually it extended to other things, from orchids to rainforest to butterflies, reptiles, and so on. So it's a thing that grew gradually from a very early age.
And I understand you were badgering your neighbours for the insides of their tea packets at one point to fuel this.
Yes, that's true, because these beautiful little painted tea cards were given away in packets of tea, like the Brooklyn Tea Company. Every summer in Britain, they'd put out a new series on something to do with the wildflowers, freshwater fish, and so on. And I used to avidly collect them. You could send away for their albums. They cost you a sixpence at the time, 5 cents, to stick them in. And a lot of kids used to do that. It's a bit like stamp collecting.
Well, as you say, a lot of kids are interested in those kind of lovely, colourful pictures of animals. But for you, this was a real lifelong passion, wasn't it? When did you notice you started to shift to be more interested in conservation?
Well, I shifted at about the age of 15, I think, from memory. And it was through certain programs on TV and articles in newspaper, because I didn't really start to read newspapers till about 15, and other ways, including these cards. These tea cards would tell you that something is some beautiful wild animal or other is still being hunted for its fur or its horn or whatever, and it's in danger of becoming extinct. And then when I read books about various animals, from the American bison to some of the South African antelopes that were rare, it infuriated me to think that we could allow this to happen, that a thing could be reduced from great herds of many animals, thousands of them, to a mere handful, and they're going to be lucky to survive unless somebody does something.
And then you moved to Australia and had to encompass a whole new range of fauna. How did that go for you?
Oh, that was good, because I didn't have much information on Australian fauna. The first time I learnt much about it was lying on my back in my bunk in the Indian Ocean with a book called On Australian Wildlife from their miniature library that they had in D-Deck. And I was able to read that, but again, I was appalled because so many things were becoming rare and extinct, and I had no idea about numbats and rabbit bandicoots, as they call them then, the bilby and so on. There was a whole lot of animals that were in danger of extinction, and I grew more and more that I wanted to help do what I could to prevent any more extinctions occurring, you know.
And so I understand you've been donating to the Worldwide Fund for Nature for a really long time. Have you seen a change, David, in how people react when you start to talk about these issues over the years? It seems to have become a bit more common knowledge, doesn't it?
Yes, that's certainly true. At one time, both in England and here, the attitude was that you were some sort of quaint eccentric that was off-centre for the main interests that people should have. I should be out there training for rugby league, or I should be interested in fishing and all sorts of recreational things that were nothing to do with it. Yet people round about here in Australia, you could go to a rainforest and see some wonderful birds and things like that and enthusiastically talk about them to people. They didn't know what you were talking about and didn't want to know, and just smirked and shook their head. And many of them in the countryside, their idea was, if it moves, shoot it. If it doesn't, chop it down, you know. And what's happened gradually over the years, with David Attenborough programs on TV and a lot more information about it in papers and things, is that people have had a change of attitude. You can see it in the Foster area, for example, up the coast. They used to shoot those fish hawks, as they call them, the ospreys. And I was appalled because they'd been wiped out in Britain, the same bird, and they just managed to come back again and protect the nests from egg robbers. And I thought it was wonderful the osprey was getting a toehold again back in Britain. But they were relatively common in Queensland and coming down to New South Wales, and people used to shoot them, and now they don't. It's unthinkable. Mm-hmm. And their numbers are increasing up there, and the attitude's very different. And if anybody wanted to go out with a gun and shoot them, I'm sure they'd be set upon by by the locals. It's changed entirely, and it's a very pleasing thing for me to witness.
We're speaking with David Waterhouse, who's been supporting the Worldwide Fund for Nature since 1962, so that's a really long time. And I'm wondering, too, if you have an issue that you care enough about to consider making a donation to the relevant charity in your will, which is what David's doing. What is the issue for you? Lots of suggestions on our Facebook page too, over at ABC Radio National. With us too is Dorothy Hodinot. She's a former principal and teacher who also has an interest in nature conservation, but she's here today to talk about why she's made a bequest to the UNHCR. Dorothy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
How did you become involved in working with refugees?
I've always had a commitment to social justice issues, but I don't think that actually started to gel until 1975, when my husband and I came back from living overseas. And I started working in schools where there were a high proportion of young refugees. At that stage in the 70s, children of people fleeing the civil war in Lebanon, for example, Vietnamese families and so on. And the stories that those children told me, and the obvious trauma that they lived with, and their needs in terms of support became a strong part of what I did. And as my teaching progressed, and I moved from one school to another, and those were all I have to say classified as disadvantaged schools, I came to focus much more on the needs of refugee children. As a principal in a school where up to 60% of the children at any one time were of refugee background, I really had to think about what their needs were. And that led me to start advocating for the needs of those children, and for the bigger picture, because there was no voice really representing those things very much in our system.
And Dorothy,
that's really how I became involved.
And it sounds like you've done an extraordinary amount of work in your 23 years at Holroyd High School, for starters. But it also sounds like you've been working on the big picture stuff, setting up scholarships, making pathways for people into higher education, putting the scaffolding around them to help with language support and other supports. But also that individual attention seems to have been key, doesn't it? That talking to each person.
Yes, and in fact, that's continued. Quite a few of my former students have discovered me on Facebook, and so I now have this wide network of people that I knew when they were children in need, who, I have to say, for the most part, are very, very successful in our community. The sort of resilience which has led to surviving all of those dreadful things, those challenges, also makes very determined, committed people. And I'm interested to see just how successful so many of my former students are. It was always a personal thing. It was always sitting down with that child to explore what they needed and to help them come to terms with their new life, and to be able to put aside as much of the trauma as is possible, so that they could move forward into the future.
And it must have been very gratifying to see the rate of people going on to university from Holroyd High hit 40% when it was 30% across the rest of the state. That must have been a satisfying thing.
Yeah, it was even higher than that in the last few years that I was at the school. And we averaged about 60% first-round university offers from a very disadvantaged school community.
So Dorothy...
And those people have been successful at university as well. A sort of real grit there, I think, in overcoming the educational disadvantage that all refugee children suffer, because their schooling is terribly interrupted. Mm. And we know how bad that is just from the lockdown. Well, I mean, it's much worse than children are experiencing now through the lockdown. And we know how children are affected both mentally and socially and also in terms of their socialization and so on, and educational standards by extended lockdowns here for children who've been through worse experiences in the refugee diaspora. The impact is huge, and so they really have to work very hard to be successful.
And Dorothy, tell us why you chose the UNHCR to make a bequest in your will.
Well, I've made bequests to a number of charities and to, let me say, performing arts organisations in my will. But the UNHCR is an important international authoritative organisation, and it has its proverbial boots on the ground in areas where many other charities can't get access. It is there in Afghanistan as we speak, under enormous difficulty, but meeting a huge need. And its capacity to do that in a disinterested fashion, that it goes in an apolitical fashion on the basis of helping, it has that international acknowledgement and acceptance that's important. And I think it also is advocating at a high level for the people that it serves. It's not simply providing the basics, and goodness gracious, it has to be the basics. It has to be basic shelter and basic food and basic sanitation, hygiene, medical support here where it's possible, education for children. It's so big. There are 82 million displaced people in the world today. I mean, there was 42 million 10 years ago. It's doubled, almost doubled in 10 years.
Yeah.
And about 27 or 28 million of those displaced persons are refugees. That is, they're displaced outside their country of origin. A reality is that they're going to live, many of them, most of them, for years in a limbo. And most will not ever be resettled.
And it's really...
So it's a question of being able to relieve on a large scale the suffering and the indignities and the misery of those people.
It's really wonderful, Dorothy and David, hearing that passion in your voices, what is a lifelong passion for both of you, and that you've found a way for that to continue even after you're gone. I really appreciate you both joining us on Life Matters today. Dorothy Hoddinott and David Waterhouse, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David's a lifelong naturalist and one of the longest supporters of the Worldwide Fund for Nature since 1962. And Dorothy Hoddinott AO, former principal and teacher at a high school in Western Sydney, which has had many refugee students over the years, many of whom she has helped herself. And if you're thinking about leaving a donation in your will, there's a quiz that helps you do it called What Kind of Legend Are You? We put a link up on the Life Matters website. It's actually really challenging. You have to work out what's important to you.